Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to VMB, the voice of Manhattan business, brought to you by the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. I'm your host, Bruce Hurwitz. You can find me on the web at hsstaffing.com. I hope everyone will be able to join me at noon next Wednesday. It will be Ann Kamen from New York Rent Company. We will be discussing planning 2017 and beyond. To learn about all future website, thevoiceofmanhattanbusiness.com. And please remember to visit the events page on the Chamber's website, .org, to learn about upcoming events on the Chamber's calendar. I am delighted to be joined today by Anil Malani from 212 Tax and Advisory Services. We will be discussing year-end tax planning. Please remember the opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views or positions of the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. If you have any questions, feel free to call in. The number is 805-243-1301 and dial 1 so I know you have a question. Anil, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
It's always a pleasure. And for those who have not had the benefit of hearing our previous interviews, tell us about yourself and your company.
Sure. I live in New York City in the Upper East Side with my wife and two daughters. And after graduating from Babson College in 2001, I worked for a couple different accounting firms, Deloitte and Weiser LLP. And when I was with them, I worked on clients such as Forever 21, LensCrafters, Merrill Lynch, and also the Rockefeller Family Office. Prior to founding 212 Tax and Accounting Services back in 2008, I served as vice president at Armel Enterprises, Inc., which was an importer and distributor of home furnishings. And over there, I oversaw the finances and the operations of a successful small business for about 5 years before making the switch over to accounting and tax. 212 Tax and Accounting Services were a full-service CPA firm servicing the tax, accounting, and consulting needs of various individuals and small businesses in New York City and the tri-state area. Our business clients vary in size from small businesses all the way to LLCs and corporations, and we span across several different industries such as nightlife and hospitality, restaurants, real estate professionals, attorneys, and doctors, among many others. That's just a little background on me and my
firm. Did you say nightlife?
Yes, we have little bit of a niche in working with couple of the larger nightclubs here in Manhattan.
Oh, okay. Now, our topic is year-end tax planning. So what should business owners be doing today to prepare for the close of the tax year on December 31st?
Sure. Well, as of right now, it being mid-November, a little bit before Thanksgiving, I think the best thing to do would to make sure your books are up to date at least till October 31st, because as you know, the October bank statements have now been released, and at least if everything's reconciled and input and classified till 10/31, you can look at the last 10 months and kind of do a little prediction or estimate for how your year is going to be. For most businesses, 10 out of 12 months is good enough. Obviously, some of the more seasonal businesses may change a lot the last 2 months. But whatever industry you're in, it can't hurt to really, look at that 10-month snapshot. When it comes to S-Corp specifically, there's things that kind of a couple more additional things you could do in terms of calculating year-end officer payroll, figuring out health insurance things for 2017, what plan you're going to put your employees on. S-Corps and LLCs both are, as we were speaking before, like flow-through entities. So you definitely want to look at as much of an estimate of your profit as possible so you can then, of course, plan for estimated tax payments, because it's usually better to make those estimated tax payments by December 31st, or at least a majority of what you're going to owe, as opposed to waiting to January, February, March, where you may have, depending on your income and tax liability, you may have penalties for waiting after year end. Another thing you could do is look at if you do have receivables, look at your bad debts. If any of your bad debts have now become truly uncollectible, you've really made reasonable attempts to collect them, write them off before year end. Why pay tax on something you're never going to collect? Then finally, we could talk about Section 179, which basically means that for most vehicles, equipment, furniture, certain fixed assets, as long as you purchase it and put it in service by December 31st, you can write off most, if not all, of the whole amount this year. So it's a great time of year to look back and say, well, what do I need now and or going into 2017? And even if I don't maybe need it till Jan, February, March, buy it now because you'll get the deduction in 16, therefore deferring your tax liability over 2017. I know that can get kind of technical, and of course I'm always happy to, you know, get into it on another show or have consultations about it if people have more questions about it, but that's definitely a key factor in terms of deferring taxes till the following year. One part of Section 179, which a lot of people like to take advantage of, especially now that gas prices are lower, are the kind of the SUV allowance. If you buy a vehicle 6,000 pounds or more, and it's at least 50% business use, you can take up to a $25,000 deduction immediately in the year you buy it and put it in service. So that's a benefit slash loophole that a lot of people enjoy, you know, especially because SUVs are so popular these days, especially for families or, you know, and a lot of course, and of course for certain businesses that need that kind of space in a car. So those are just the kind of the few major things that people should business owners should start focusing on this time of year.
Thank you for that. And all right, so that gets us to December 31st. What do business owners need to do, and when do they need to do it after January 1st to be able to file on time for March 15th?
Sure. So it's kind of this, you know, the same thing. I mean, get your books in order, right? If you've done the 10 months and then 11 months, you know, after Thanksgiving or when December comes around, if you can get November sealed off, then really you only have the end of the year will be a lot better because you really only have 1 month to close out. So if you're prepared before the end of the year, January will, of course, be a lot easier. And then you just got to get your books and records over to your accountant, assuming you're using one. If not, of course, if you're doing it yourself, then getting through that process in terms of maybe importing the QuickBooks to the other softwares or whatever it is. But it's important to get your December 31st financials reconciled and classified properly so then you can at least get the ball rolling on the tax process. You can't start the tax process unless you have to know what your actual profit was because taxes are, of course, based on your profits. So it's really, you know, Jan 5th, Jan 10th, whenever you recover from your New Year's hangover or whatever it is you did for New Year's Eve, it's never too early to really start the process, especially because March 15th is really just around the corner. One important thing this year is that they are switching around two major dates. They're moving up partnership LLCs, 1065s. They're moving that up from April to March 15th from April 15th, so it's going to be due 30 days earlier. And then for C-Corps, they're moving from March 15th to April 15th. And it really makes a lot of sense because partnership LLCs issue K-1s. So, and you need those K-1s to do your personal returns if you're a member of an LLC, where C-Corps don't issue K-1s because they're not flow-through entities. So this little switch up that the IRS announced almost a year and a half ago, but now is going to take place in 2017, will hopefully help, definitely help accountants, but also help clients and taxpayers all over the country who have these types of entities set up.
So we all know that there are plenty of procrastinators in the world, and if somebody is unsuccessful in getting everything done that needs to be done by the time it needs to be done, how do you get an extension? What's the process?
We were talking before, you know, it's usually better to do an extension online because you can just easily print out the confirmation or save it as a PDF or whatever you want to do if you file it online yourself, either through, you know, the federal and state websites or through your tax software. Of course, if you're using an accountant, you would just really send them something in writing saying you want to file an extension. But either way, whether you're using an accountant or doing it yourself, you want to have that printout or PDF that you have that a confirmation that the extension has been filed, because it happens way too many times where these penalties and bills get issued for not filing the extension, but you really did, you thought you filed it at least, maybe it didn't go through online or they didn't get it in the mail. Or I mean, if you really want to do it by paper, you can still, I think they're still accepting certified mail, but it's definitely not the most efficient way to do it anymore. Another thing to really consider if you are going to file an extension is it's an extension of time to file, not to pay. So you must make sure that you pay at least 75 to 90% of your liability, if not more, with your extension to avoid penalties. Because just filing an extension and paying little to no tax really isn't going to do much for you when it comes time to file the return.
It sounds
so
like
those are, of course,
form.
The major points of filing extensions. You know, it's I don't see it as that complicated a process, but I do see it as you have to still have an estimate of your profit in order to pay a good estimate of your tax liability. Otherwise, if you're just filing it blindly, you know, it's not really going to do much for you. That's the way
but
I see it.
But it's pro forma. They always approve it?
Yeah, well, all an extension really is just you're not really sending much information. You're just saying an estimate of how much you're going to pay. Estimate of how much you're going to owe and then how much you're actually paying. So that's there's only a couple numbers going on the form there. You're not really sending any revenue or expense information.
As a recruiter, probably the number one question that I get asked when somebody is hiring me to find staff for them is, can the person be on a 1099 or do they have to be on a W-2? And I have my list of questions that I ask. How do you determine who gets the W-2? In other words, who's an employer? I pull an employee, and who's gets a 1099, meaning they're a consultant.
So, if you don't mind me kind of answering a question with a question, there is the list you use. Is that based off what's on IRS.gov at all?
Yes.
Or is that somewhere
else? Of course. I'm crazy. I'm not stupid. And the first thing I say is I'm not an attorney. And the second thing I say is I'm not an accountant. But according to the IRS, and then I continue on from there.
Right. So it's that 20-point factor test that's on IRS.gov that,
yeah,
you know, anyone can really just Google and really go through it if they want to know the actual, what the book says and the technicalities. I mean, the way I see it from a higher level is, look, if you're reporting to the same place of work, you know, majority of the time, you're under the same supervisor a majority of the time, you have little to no other outside income, you don't have your own website, business card, you're not invoicing, then you're probably a W-2 employee. Now, whether your employer chooses to still treat you as 1099 and you choose to accept that, that's another thing. You know, being in the business that I'm in, you know, almost every day I'll see someone ask me a 1099 question or bring in a 1099. And when we get into the other details of their tax situation, to me it's like, well, in my head I'm thinking you're really an employee. But then it's really not, you know, necessarily my job or, you know, to go out and, like, report all these companies that should be treating them as employees. I mean, if they want to file a complaint, you know, they can. But then it's such a gray area, then it's usually not worth the people's time, you know. So, if you're truly an independent contractor, LLC Corp, you, like I said, you have a website, business card, you invoice, you have at least two or three streams of income, you know, then you probably are an independent contractor, you know. I try to back up, not really get into those 20 questions, because you could talk about those forever and run in circles forever, you know. Unfortunately, you know, this part of the tax law is interpreted in many different ways, not often the correct way, and then it's up to the government to pick and choose who they go after in this case, because they're really the only ones that are going to enforce the law.
And who gets sent to Sing Sing? Is it the employer, the employee, or the consultant, or
no,
both
it's,
of them?
No, it's usually – it's going to fall on the employer because they're going to have to be assessed a certain amount of payroll taxes and other penalties and fines. I mean, there's really nothing to go after. If the employee or the independent contractor, the person receiving the money, as long as they're filing and paying their taxes, they're doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, maybe if they really should be an employee and they're not, they're paying a little more of the FICA and Medicare, more of the self-employment tax, so they're getting penalized from a monetary situation like that. But, you know, it's the employer that's really the one who's, like, paying less tax or saving money. So it's usually the employer who gets hit. And there's several different agencies that can hit them for it. It can be, like unemployment, IRS, New York State, New York City, Department of Labor. I mean, there's different agencies that, you know, can enforce this type of law and assess the penalties accordingly.
Understood. Now, just a reminder, you're listening to The Voice of Manhattan Business. My guest today is Anil Malwani from 212 Tax and Advisory Services. We are discussing year-end tax planning. If you have any questions, feel free to call in. The number is 805-243-1301, and dial 1 so I know you have a question. Please remember the opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views or positions of the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. Anil, talk to us about the Affordable Care Act as it pertains to reporting and fines or taxes.
Oh, I thought Trump already repealed it. Did I miss something?
Not yet, so no, it's still going to be.
The good news for people like our, most of the people we deal with, me and you here in the city, you know, we're well under 50 employees. It doesn't generally affect us because the government, at least whatever your opinion was of Obamacare, they knew that the really, you know, under 50 employee businesses would not be able to survive with these types of regulations and requirements and penalties and fines and all that stuff. So if you have 50 or more, you know, there's definitely things to consider. If you have 50 employees, you need to offer some type of minimum coverage that's supposed to be, in quotes, affordable. And then you have to report all of this, everything that you're offering, you have to report to the IRS on at least an annual basis. If what you offer leads to your employees getting a premium tax credit on their tax returns, you may be subject to a penalty for not offering enough coverage for them not to get that credit. Because employees' premiums paid cannot be more, they're not supposed to be more than 9.5% of annual household income. So that's why if they end up getting the tax credit, that's why the penalty may be assessed. And generally what the penalties are, I mean, it's, you know, on average, probably $2,000 to $3,000 an employee. You know, we can get really technical, get into the details of it, but on a higher level, it's $2,000 to $3,000 an employee if you aren't complying with what you're supposed to do if you're 50 or more employees. Part of the main forms, I don't know if you've seen these 1090. We, of course, see them at least 1095 forms. There's 1095 A, B, C. That's really depending on how many employees you have and what kind of coverage you offer. That's the additional form, the 1095, that needs to be filed by the employer in addition to reporting on the W-2. If it's paper, no later than February 28th. If it's electronic, they give you till March 31st to file these forms. I don't really love that because people are coming in to do their taxes sometimes before they get this form or they forget the form, and it does lead to a kind of mess. So one thing we know for this coming tax season, we're going to put that on our organizer and make sure that if you do have a 1095, that you must bring it in with all your other paperwork or send it in, because more times than not, it's going to lead to a notice or a bill coming where we're going to have to do additional work later to fix it. So that's definitely become a key form since the Affordable Care Act got enacted a couple of years ago.
And that 1095 is for everyone or just those with 50 or more employees?
Generally those with 50 or more employees.
Yeah.
So some smaller companies might still do it anyway because they're offering coverage and they want to do it, but they don't have to.
Gotcha. Now, what do employers need to know about their pension plans?
The main thing is that there's options. You know, fortunately, we have there's a few different ones out there. I know some people feel like, just like the tax code in general, there's too much out there. But just to run through, I guess, the most popular ones, defined contribution plans include 401ks, profit-sharing plans, and money purchase plans. These generally work for most types and sizes of businesses, and contributions are made by the employee and the employer. As of right now, the max contribution is $18,000 by the employee. And the matching by the employer, of course, can vary. A SEP plan, a simplified employee pension plan, is usually better for the small businesses, and only the employer makes contributions here. And that can be technically up to 25% of net earnings, up no more than $43,000 per employee. So, like, that's kind of what I have for my business, what a lot of small businesses usually do, because most financial institutions don't charge any fees for having a SEP, and there's no IRS reporting requirement. That's why it's popular among, like, smaller businesses. Simple IRAs are not so popular anymore because of the popularity of the SEP. Simple IRAs are similar to 401ks. Both the employee and the employer may contribute to the plan. And you can have, as long as you have under 100 employees, you can have a simple IRA. A contribution from the employee max is $12,500, and the employer either matches 3% of compensation or contributes 2% of each eligible employee's compensation to the simple IRA. Like I said, for SEP IRAs and simple IRAs, there's no IRS reporting requirement. But for 401ks and most profit-sharing plans, there usually is an IRS reporting requirement. So it's something else you have to have your accountant file for you for those plans based on IRS regulations. Which is, that's hopefully enough of a rundown, I think, for now,
it
right,
is,
on the pension plan.
Now, I apologize. As I told you before the show began, I am fighting a cold, and I just had a little bit of a coughing jag, but it seems to be over, so I should be able to get the next couple questions out.
Sure, no
this
problem.
Topic
if you need any
really
help,
is interesting. Explain that, well, you know, some tea with honey would be helpful, but I don't think you can get it to me. Explain the tax ramifications for employers and employees when employers give employees non-monetary bonuses, such as theater tickets or extra unpaid vacation days.
Sure. So starting off with the extra vacation days, there is no tax effect on that because the IRS is concerned with how much you get paid, monetary or non-monetary, not how much you work. So you work over, you know, assuming you're a salary employee, not subject to overtime, you work extra days, less days, you're taxed on your compensation. Most other fringe benefits, like theater tickets, are always taxable. Season tickets to sporting events, commuting use for an employer-provided vehicle for more than one day a month, membership in a private country club or athletic facility, use of employer-owned or leased facilities such as an apartment, boat, hunting lodge for a weekend, all of that is supposed to be taxed also. And usually it's, if you, the right way to do it is to add it somehow, put a value on it and add it to the W-2. Things that the IRS generally does not go after, they call them de minimis fringe benefits, are traditional birthday and holiday gifts, of as long as it's not cash, with low fair market values, occasional cocktail parties, group meals, picnics for employees or their guests, occasional once every couple of years theater, sporting event tickets, of course coffee, donuts, soft drinks they're not going after, flowers, fruit, books, similar property, you know, on account of an illness, family crisis. Meals. If it's meals for working late or, you know, working late or working overtime or, like, as long as it's not too consistent, then no. But if it's very consistent and it's not for any special reason, then that technically should be taxable, yes.
Hmm.
And, of course, like things like copying, you know, personal use of the copying machine, telephone calls, they're not really looking to go after that stuff. That's all considered de minimis. It's not worth their time. The thing that they are stringent on is cash in any value. If it's cash or gift certificate or a gift card, no matter what, that is supposed to be taxable and reported on the W-2, no matter what the amount is.
Now, my last question is totally open-ended. What haven't I asked you? What should we discuss that we haven't discussed?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it's, I don't know if it's the elephant in the room or it's just me, but, you know, obviously we have a change in administration in the very near future. Not only that, but we have we're going to have a Republican Congress too. So the chances for change in the tax code are definitely pretty high. Of course, nothing's definite yet. But what President-elect Trump has mentioned is cutting the corporate rate from 35% to 15%. He's also mentioned if he is able to pass that, it will also apply to the smaller businesses, the LLCs, the S-Corps, even though they're flow through and they're not technically paying the corporate rate, he would apply that same rate on that income, on that kind of actively earned income to S-Corps and LLCs. So this would, of course, reduce the tax revenue quite a bit. I mean, if you're talking about like a 20% cut. But then again, I guess what at least most Republicans see it benefiting us is that it will cause a lot of expansion and new hiring. Of course, that's not definite, and that's, you know, sure. It'll be very interesting to see how this all pans out. For number one, of course, what gets approved and what gets enacted, and then the effects on the economy. We, you know, of course, no one knows for sure. President-elect Trump's also talking about boosting the standard deduction and eliminating personal independent exemptions, and of course, collapsing the brackets from 7 rates to 3. The 3 rates would be apparently 12%, 25%, and then 33%. And the capital gains rates, he's saying, will probably keep the same, which I think I don't think anyone really disagrees with that. So, general
none of this would be applicable to 2016?
I don't think that any of this can be done in time for that. I assume right. that if it's going to happen, it would be applied to 17. But you do never know. I mean, I think it's possible, and it happened in history where it could be retroactive. But I guess we will see. There's definitely been a lot of last minute changes. I mean, we've seen it as accountants, and you know, they delay the e-filing, they delay the software updates. So it's not. But I more than likely it'll be at the soonest for tax year 17. I don't think it's going to be able to be enacted for 16. It won't, because he's only going to, of course, take over on January 20th or whatever the closest week date that is. So like. By then, we're supposed to already start e-filing 16. You know, we can't, so I don't think that's why I don't think it's going to happen.
Agreed.
So, and of course, and then finally, I mean, he's mentioned how the estate and death tax, whatever you want to call it, the allowance now, the tax-free allowance now is around the $5 million range. He's been speaking about raising it to $10 million. So those are, again, these are things that, you know, there probably will be at least some changes. It'll just be a matter of how many changes there are and the effects they have. But, you know, I just hope that of course the economy can improve in the right way. You know, it's not just about tax cuts; it's about the overall improvement in the economy. So, you know, like other fellow Americans, just hope that we can have some good, real positive changes now that we've gone through this election.
For me, the judge will be the civilian employment participation rates. That's the number I care about.
Right, that makes sense.
Because if that goes up, that means that the job market's improving.
Right. Yeah. Jobs are number one, right, on the agenda. That's what they always say.
That's right. And the number 10 thing on the agenda, my 10th question, as you know, and I want to thank you. You've been a great guest. You've come on so often, and hopefully you'll come on next year and we can discuss whatever changes the new administration will enact. But for right now, and before I start coughing again, what's the best way for people to get in touch?
Sure. So the easiest way is on our website, 212tax.com. You can submit an inquiry through there. You can read all about our firm, all about the services we provide, the industries we serve, and there's just also just general, you know, free advice and resources for most kinds of tax issues and tax questions. We do a blog once a month. We're not only doing written blogs, we're doing video blogs. So our website is informative. Whether or not you're interested in becoming a client, it's definitely something good to check out. Of course, if you ever want to email me directly, my email is pretty easy. It's just cpa@212tax.com. That's cpa@212tax.com. And our phone number is 212-475-1040. And, of course, if you want to stop by the office, we're open Monday to Friday from 8:30 to 6:30 year-round. And we do add Saturday hours during tax season and evening hours and Saturday hours during tax season. So it's usually better to make an appointment if possible. But if you happen to be in the area, we're just a block south of Grand Central. We're at 370 Lexington Avenue at 41st Street. So feel free to drop by or give us a call or email anytime.
Anil, thank you very much for coming back on. I look forward to your joining us next year as well. And as always, a special thank you to our listeners. And I know Anil joins me in wishing everyone a safe and prosperous week. Thank you for listening.